My first research advisor ever, and this is way back when I was an undergraduate at California Polytechnic State University, or Cal Poly, if you're cool. This is back in the early 2000s. My advisor was Dr. Tsunefumi Tanaka. He was an expert in relativity, in general relativity, special relativity. He taught courses on the subjects. His own research was based in relativity. Now, relativists are not as common as you might think, but he was one of them. He was an expert in general relativity. And one day, I remember in class, it was a class on general relativity, and he's talking to the class, and you know, when you can get a professor going on some little side tangent, especially about their lives, they always take you up on the offer and they start reminiscing. And I remember him distinctly making an offhand comment about the career options for scientists, for physicists, and then especially specialists like him in relativity, relativists. And he said, if you want to be a relativist, all you get to do is make templates. Templates, 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 just a bunch of templates. It's so boring. I went on to do a project with him that had nothing at all to do with templates. And if you're curious, it was calculating Casimir forces for flat universes with different topologies. But the paper is on my website if you're interested in. But to get at what Dr. Tanaka was talking about, we need to set the clock back another 100 years. We need to talk about Einstein and the discovery of gravitational waves. First off, the equations of general relativity are hard. And not just, oh, physics is hard. For physicists, general relativity is hard. General relativity, this is our understanding of gravity. It's so easy to say that, oh, if you have mass or energy, you distort space-time around you. And then the distortion of space-time tells mass and energy how to behave and move and stuff. Sounds super easy. In reality, it is a set of 10 nonlinear equations that are all coupled together and are basically impossible to solve. It is a nasty set of equations. It's very elegant. It's very beautiful to write down. You can write down very, very compact forms of these equations, but buried under the surface is just nastiness. And that's why there are not a lot of relativists. There are not a lot of specialists in general relativity among the physics community because it's hard and it's complicated and it's tough to make progress. And this is one of the reasons why general relativity took forever to take off. Like Einstein made it in the 1910s. And then we realized it was largely correct, but then no one knew how to actually make progress in it and how to solve problems with it and apply it to interesting, unusual circumstances. And so it just sat around for decades. It took really until the 1950s and 60s before general relativity became, you know, a fashionable topic. And even then, even after then, it hasn't been the hottest topic in physics. It's high energy physics, particle colliders, that stuff is easier than general relativity. But because the equations of GR are so dang hard, you have to come up with lots of tricks to simplify them so you can actually get work done. One trick is called linearization, and I won't get into the technical details of that little nugget, but for our purposes, it just means that the equations are simpler to handle. You're looking at a simplified version of the equations that are not applicable to all cases, but you can actually write down solutions and get work done and make progress, and so you can hopefully gain some physical insight. And it's an approximation that holds true when gravity isn't all that strong. And it's in this simplified version of GR that Einstein discovered gravitational waves, which is, as the name suggests, a literal wave in space-time. It's a ripple in space-time. Just like you can have water waves and sound waves and electromagnetic waves, you can have waves of gravity. Gravity can come at you in waves. It's so cool to think about it. We're used to gravity as just being a presence, a force. The Earth exerts a gravitational force on us and we feel it all the time and it's constant. It's just there. But a gravitational wave is a ripple of gravity. where the gravity can get stronger and weaker as the ripple washes over you. It's a cool concept. It's a weird thing to think about. And at first glance, it might be a little bit too weird. Einstein himself, as soon as he wrote the paper saying, hey, gravitational waves might exist, he doubted their existence. He thought it might be an artifact of the simplification process and not a real thing. Which is a valid argument. It's like saying, well, the math says so. This is why we use math, is because it tells us things that are true in physics. But we did all this simplification process, so are we seeing something that's actually reflected in nature? Or is it because this approximation doesn't actually hold? And yeah, it comes out in the math, but this setup doesn't actually accurately describe nature. The math says so, but if you have to torture the math to get there, you know, you're not exactly sure if it's telling the truth or not. Maybe it's just telling you what you want it to hear. Einstein equivocated on it to his grave. The debate went on for decades because GR is really, really hard to make progress in, and not a lot of people were working on it. At the time, quantum mechanics, quantum field theory were way more interesting and way more tractable. You can actually make progress in those fields, and so people made progress in those fields. Eventually, in the 1950s, we realized that gravitational waves work in the full non-simplified equations of GR, which means they were legit. Now what? Gravitational waves exist. What does a gravitational wave do? First off, I need to clarify something about the name here. I'm going to be absolutely careful during this episode, and I need you to be absolutely careful when you talk about it with friends and relatives and acquaintances and dinner dates. It is not a gravity wave. It is a gravitational wave. The reason they are called gravitational waves and not gravity waves is because the name gravity waves is already taken. These are a kind of wave in the atmosphere that were studied decades before GR came on the scene. So the name was taken. We couldn't call these things gravity waves because gravity waves is something else. You have to call it gravitational waves. To think of a gravitational wave, let's start with a water wave. Like when you think of a water wave, you think of up and down. The wave washes over you and you bob up and down. When a sound wave comes at you, these are waves of pressure in the air, and you think in and out, the air molecules get closer together and then they spread out, and they get closer again and then they spread. So you think in and out, in and out. When it comes to gravitational waves, you need to think stretch and squeeze. Remember, this ripple in the fabric of space-time is literally a wave of gravity. It is waves of forces of gravity. So as the wave washes over you, you will get squeezed in one direction and pulled in the other. And then more of the wave washes over you and you get squished in the opposite direction and then pulled in the opposite direction, then back and forth. So like your sides will go in and out and your head and toes will go in and out and they'll alternate back and forth. And you will feel it. You will feel this force. It will feel like giant soft hands are squishing on your side and then pulling on your side and squishing on your head and pulling on your head, stretching and squeezing like you're a piece of Play-Doh. That's what it feels like to experience a gravitational wave, is this stretching and pulling. And the stretching and squeezing will be perpendicular to the direction of motion for a gravitational wave. When a water wave is washing over you, it might be moving in one direction, but you move perpendicular to that direction. It's say the wave is going to shore in that direction, but you go up and down. You're moving perpendicular to that. When the gravitational wave is moving through you, front to back, you are getting squeezed head to toe and side to side. The force, the action of the force is perpendicular to that. There is no back and forth motion when it comes to gravitational waves. It's just the stretching and the squeezing. Also, I've seen a lot of people ask, like you people, if there is also time dilation going on here. And the answer is no. Gravitational waves are just waves of space. So sometimes when writers are talking about gravitational waves, they'll say ripples in the fabric of space-time. And yeah, that's technically true because all space-time is unified. You always have to talk about it connected together. But it is just gravitational waves of space. There is no effect on time here. The dimension of time is not getting manipulated by a gravitational wave. A gravitational wave has all the normal wave properties that you have come to know and love and respect and expect. There is a wavelength or a frequency. As the gravitational wave is washing over you and there's these invisible soft hands squeezing on you and pulling on you in very odd ways, it's like a massage that you're not sure if you should pay for at the end or not because it's getting weird. Like any wave, there will be a frequency. How often the squeezing comes, how often the stretching comes. Like any wave, there will be an amplitude, how big the stretch is, how big the squeeze is. Like any wave, it will carry energy and momentum away from one place and towards another place. Like, you are getting stretched and squeezed by the wave. That is a transfer of energy. Something generated that wave. Something generated the energy necessary. That energy was carried away by the wave, and then the wave manipulating you sends some of that energy to you that was radiated long ago. Just like any other wave. You know, a storm hits the middle of the ocean, and then you get to bob up and down in the shore. That is the transfer of energy from the storm to your body through the action of the ocean waves. Just like any other wave, they travel at a certain speed. Sound waves go at a certain speed. Ocean waves go at a certain speed. In this case, the speed of gravitational waves is the speed of light. One way to understand why gravitational waves travel the speed of light is to look at the role that gravitational waves play in GR. And keep in mind that what I'm about to describe is a very modern understanding of how gravitational waves work and how they operate and the role they play in the whole gravity game. This was not at all obvious to Einstein when he first discovered them. It took many decades to figure out exactly how gravitational waves work, but I want you to imagine this scenario because it's very helpful pedagogically. All right, we've got our sun, right? It's the big glowing thing in the sky, in case you haven't been out in a while. Let's say we got the Earth in orbit around the sun. And let's say the sun disappeared. Just gone. How long would it take for us to find out? Well, we know that it takes light 8.5 minutes to go from the surface of the sun to our eyeballs. And so presumably you might guess it would take 8.5 minutes for us to find out because all of a sudden the sun would stop sending out light, but it had already sent out light and it's going to take 8.5 minutes for that lack of light to reach the Earth. And we're going to be like, oh, right. Wow. There's no more sun. Who turned it off? What do we do now? Do we start eating each other now? Or do we wait until the food? Okay. We wait. Oh, it's the ethical thing to wait. Okay. So if the sun were to go out, it would take 8.5 minutes for the electromagnetic waves, the light waves, to reach us, for that signal to reach us. But what about gravity? The Earth is in orbit around the sun. It's traveling at this incredibly fast speed, but it's kept in orbit from the gravity of the sun. Now, if the sun were to disappear, there'd be no more gravity, and the Earth would just fling off into space, heading out into the interstellar voids as we eat each other. Would that be felt instantly? I mean, that's how we thought normal gravity worked back before GR, and it was just Newtonian gravity. The assumption was gravity happened instantaneously, which seems kind of weird, because if the light doesn't reach us for 8.5 minutes, why should the gravitational signal get here any sooner? So now we have a complete picture of what would happen. You can think of the sun embedded in space-time as bending and curving space-time. And however you want to envision that in your mind, feel free. If you want to imagine a heavy bowling ball sitting on a rubber mat, if you want to imagine it embedded in three dimensions and everything's like curving around it, go right ahead. But the mass of the sun is causing space to bend around it, which is what's keeping the Earth in its orbit. And if you were to get rid of the sun, well, there'd be a big plop. There'd be a big change. All this bending would go away. And the first parts to go away would be the parts closest to the sun. They'd be like, oh, no more sun here. So I got to return back to flat space time. And then the parts just past that would get that signal. Oh, there's nothing inside of me. So I got to return to flat space time. And then it would go outward, outward, outward. You can imagine a pulse of signal in gravity as space itself reset from the lack of the presence of the sun. a pulse would go out. And that pulse would travel at the speed of light, because it's not going to get here any faster. So take that scenario in your head, and instead of having the sun disappear and us eating each other, imagine taking the sun and just wiggling it back and forth. You can imagine the pulses of that signal rippling away from the sun. Those pulses traveling at the speed of light are the gravitational waves. And like to make something a wave, all you need to do is wiggle. This is not surprising. If you're sitting in ocean water and you wiggle around, you generate water waves. If you're sitting in an atmosphere and you make your voice box, your larynx wiggle, you make sound waves. If you take an electron and wiggle it back and forth, you make electromagnetic waves. And if you take a massive object and wiggle it back and forth, you get gravitational waves. And these waves travel at the speed of light, because what other speed could they possibly travel at? I need to mention something else about the waves. Gravitational waves are exceedingly weak. And I mean exceedingly. And I don't think you understand just how exceedingly I mean here. Gravity is by far the weakest of the forces, which is a big mystery in physics. But that's another show. Feel free to ask, why is gravity so weak? It's called the hierarchy problem. Love to do an episode on that, but not today. If gravity were a billion, 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 billion times stronger than it is, it would still be the weakest force by billions and billions. It's just so weak. And then gravitational waves are tiny little things on top of the normal gravity. So this isn't the normal gravity of the Earth. Gravitational waves are something tiny on top of that. So you're taking something that is billions of times weaker than anything else in the universe, and then you're taking a weaker version of that. Tiny little variations on that. So gravitational waves are exceedingly weak. That's a bad thing, because it makes them hard to detect. But it's also a good thing. It's a good thing, because gravitational waves don't really interact with matter. So they pass through the universe without any scattering or absorption. All the nasty stuff we have to deal with light. Oh, there's some dust, and it absorbed all the light, so we can't get a good image of that supernova. Oh, our planet is opaque, so we can't see inside of it to know what's going on in our core. The light can't get out. That's not true with gravitational waves. Gravitational waves, because they're so weak, they barely interact with matter, and so they just sail on through. And they sail on through the universe. Gravitational waves can go for billions of light years. And yeah, they'll get weaker because they're getting spread out in more volume, but they won't scatter, they won't get absorbed, they'll just keep on going. So great, gravitational waves exist. They do things, which is mostly wave around. How do you get one? Like I said, you get one by wiggling. If you start wiggling around, which I greatly encourage you to do, then you are generating gravitational waves. Like, look, I'm waving my arm right now. Can't you hear it? I am making gravitational waves. And if you wave your arm right now, you are making gravitational waves. You just take mass and you accelerate it. Boom, done. Gravitational waves. Easiest thing to make in the world. This does lead to something cool I absolutely need to tell you about. I cannot resist it. It's called permanence. Anything, any mass or energy that is changing or accelerating will create gravitational waves, including gravitational waves. So if you're waving your arm around, you make some gravitational waves. Those gravitational waves are energy moving around, which generate gravitational waves. So gravitational waves generate gravitational waves, weaker versions of them, but still gravitational waves. Then those gravitational waves go on to make more gravitational waves. It keeps going and going and going, with every iteration getting weaker and weaker and weaker. But when you add up all the contributions to all those infinite waves that are constantly created, you actually end up with a permanent distortion in space. Gravitational waves permanently shift space-time behind them from this stacking of gravitational waves. Once you trigger one, you can't stop it, and it leaves behind a very, very, very tiny, but very, very real permanent gravitational wave presence. I thought that was cool. But like I said, they're weak. So technically, any accelerating mass makes gravitational waves. But if you want to make anything appreciable, anything decent, you need some really beefy stuff. Most importantly, you need a lot of energy concentrated into as small a volume as possible. Imagine making a water wave. If you drop a little leaf on a pond, it's going to make hardly any wave at all. But if you drop a massive boulder on the pond, that's going to make a big wave. So you need something big here with gravitational waves. Some good candidates for making decent gravitational waves might be black holes colliding, neutron stars colliding, black holes colliding with neutron stars, supernova exploding, giant black holes colliding, giant black holes eating things, and let's not forget, the entire universe. What all these have in common is a lot of mass concentrated into a very small volume, doing something really quickly. Like when black holes collide, you've got a lot of mass in those singularities, a lot of density, infinite density, I guess, crashing into each other at nearly the speed of light. That's going to be pretty serious. When a star turns itself inside out and goes supernova, that's a lot of mass, a lot of energy, a lot of action. When a giant black hole is literally tearing apart a star limb from limb, that's a lot of mass, a lot of energy, a lot of density, a lot of gravitational waves. The early universe was a very chaotic place. I'm talking about when it was less than a second old. It was going through some radical phase transitions. Those radical phase transitions released gravitational waves that shook the entire cosmos. These are prime sources for gravitational waves. And gravitational waves, because they pass through matter so easily, they let us see inside of it. A supernova, you can't see inside of a supernova because prior to the supernova is just a star and you can't see inside of stars. And then it explodes and all you see is the explosion. So you don't actually get to see and observe directly what's happening inside of a supernova as it's going off. But as it's going off, it's releasing gravitational waves, which just sail on through. And if you can detect those gravitational waves, you can see what's happening inside of a star as it dies. When two black holes collide in the middle of the night, that's black hole number one, black hole number two, space itself is black. That's not a lot of electromagnetic radiation coming off of that thing. You're not going to see it with any telescope, but you can detect the gravitational waves released. Gravitational waves are powerful because they let us see things that we can't normally see. And when it comes to detection, this is where the templates come in. And what Dr. Tanaka was complaining about. Before I continue, I wanted to let you know that this episode of Ask a Spaceman is brought to you by my friends at BetterHelp. BetterHelp provides easy, convenient, affordable access to online counseling and therapy. And therapy has been an important part of my life experience. It is something I'm absolutely not ashamed to talk about. I wish more people used therapists and counselors to take better care of their own mental health, just like they take care of their physical health. I know a lot of you tune into this show for astrotherapy, as it were, but maybe if you're having a really tough time, you should talk to an actual professional. And so I encourage you to go to BetterHelp. They are convenient and professional. It's real therapy and counseling, and it is affordable, and you can connect online. You don't have to wait in a waiting room or any of that. You just talk to someone who cares and knows what they're talking about. Listen, as a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting BetterHelp at betterhelp.com/spaceman. And I want you to join over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health. Again, that's BetterHelp, HELP.com/spaceman. Now, back to our astrotherapy session, brought to you by not a licensed psychologist, but an astrophysicist. But good enough, right? At least for now. If we're going to build gravitational wave detectors, if we want to actually see, there are all these things happening in the universe that are generating gravitational waves. Presumably, these gravitational waves are washing over the Earth right now. There are gravitational waves sailing through you right now from distant events, from neutron stars colliding, from giant black holes eating things, from the first second of the universe itself, washing over you right now. We need to know what we're looking for. We needed to model the unique gravitational wave signal, or the fingerprint of each of these sources. all these different sources, the supernovae, the black holes colliding, the black holes eating things, the black holes doing other things, the black holes just being black holes. All these different sources have different characteristic frequencies, wavelengths, amplitudes, behaviors, patterns. And as gravitational waves progress throughout the universe, they're affected by cosmological redshift. They get redshifted just like light does. They get stretched to lower frequencies just like light does. So we need to figure out what we can detect. Like if a supernova goes off in our backyard, how strong is that gravitational wave when it hits the Earth? What does that gravitational wave look like? If two black holes merge in a distant galaxy and the gravitational wave finally reaches the Earth, how strong is that gravitational wave? What's its frequency? What's its amplitude? Does it have any particular patterns? Does it shift to higher amplitude or lower amplitude? Does it change frequencies? What does it do? We need to figure it out. So we need templates for this. It's like being able to identify bird calls. You stand in the middle of a forest or a jungle and hear all sorts of noises. And what you want to do is you really wanted, I don't know, the ruby-throated golden warbler. And you really, really want to hear and spot the ruby, what did I just make up? The ruby-throated golden warbler. And it has a distinct call. So you're sitting here in a jungle, and imagine you're hearing all sorts of noises. There's the wind rustling through the trees. There's the buzzing of insects. There's a howler monkey nearby. And you're listening through all these sounds, but you've got a template because you had an app, and you listened on the app to what the ruby-throated, why did I pick this? The ruby-throated golden warbler, what it sounds like. That was your template. And you're listening to all these noises, and then you finally hear it. There it is! And it matches the template. And it rises above. You can select it. There's all these noises, but you know that noise. And that noise is the ruby-throated golden warbler. That was it. Gravitational waves, we needed these templates. There's gravitational waves washing over us nonstop from sources across the universe. We need to know what we are hearing so we can identify it. Plus, when black holes collide, all sorts of different masses of black holes can be involved. And so there'll be different templates. All sorts of different spins can be involved. We need different templates. Sometimes those black holes can have accretion disks, which have their own voice to the party. So we need templates for that. So in the 1980s, 1990s, early 2000s, it was template town. If you wanted to be a relativist, you needed to work on templates because that's what everyone was doing, was building templates so that future gravitational wave detectors would be able to spot that ruby-throated golden warbler. For example, black hole collisions, if it's a black hole a few times the mass of the sun, have a gravitational wave frequency of about 100 hertz. That means that as the gravitational wave from these black holes washed over you, you would get stretched and squeezed about 100 times per second as the wave passed through you. Converted into sound, if we were to take 100 hertz as a sound wave, that's actually audible to humans. Check this out. So that could be the template or the beginning of a template for detecting black hole collisions. If you see a gravitational wave and you've got your detector and you see something that hits the detector with a frequency of about 100 hertz, boom, you got it. That's the beginning of a template. Things like supernova are higher frequency. Things like giant merging black holes are lower frequency. But now we know, because we spent a couple decades developing all the templates for what the gravitational wave signature or fingerprint would look like from these different sources. But even though these gravitational waves are coming from all across the universe, passing through you right now, as we speak, distorting you, don't you feel those awkward hands on you? You don't exactly feel them. Remember how I said they were weak? Check this out. Let me give you some numbers. You know antimatter, right? It's exactly like matter, but has opposite electric charge. And the cool thing about antimatter is that if you touch regular matter to antimatter, they annihilate and convert all of their mass into 100% energy, They convert it into high-energy photons. Very, very cool. If you smash 1 pound of antimatter into 1 pound of normal matter, you have released the same amount of energy as a 19-megaton nuclear bomb. 1 pound. Like 1 pound that you can hold in your hand of antimatter. Basically, as soon as it touches your hand, because your hand is made of normal matter, the whole thing explodes, and you've released more energy than a 19-megaton nuclear bomb. That's a lot. Now, imagine taking our sun, and then another sun made out of antimatter. So we have a sun and an anti-sun, and you smash them together to see what happens. Here's what happens. They blow up. Every single atom of hydrogen, every single atom of helium, smashes into every single atom of anti-hydrogen and anti-helium. All that mass, an entire sun's mass, converted into pure energy. 1 pound could do more damage than a nuclear bomb. One sun's worth of antimatter colliding with one sun's worth of matter releases more energy than every star in the entire observable universe is releasing right now. So in that 1 second when the explosion happened, it is more energetic than every single star in the universe combined. That's a lot of energy. A typical black hole collision will release several times that, up to hundreds of times that, in the form of gravitational waves. Imagine that scenario. These two black holes, you can't even see them. This is silent. This is dark. There's no flash. There's no bang. There's no explosion. There are no fireworks. But in the merger process, they release more energy than 100 universes worth of stars. All in the form of gravitational waves. If you were within, say, a kilometer of the event, the gravitational waves would rip you to shreds. But gravitational waves are so weak. If you were 1,000 kilometers away from a black hole collision, you'd be totally fine. Yeah, maybe a little uncomfortable, like you had too much gas, but it wouldn't really trouble you. That's how weak these are. More energy than 100 universes worth of stars, and 1,000 kilometers away, you would barely feel it. By the time those same gravitational waves make it to the Earth, billions of light years away, they are washing over you right now. They are stretching and squeezing you less than the width of a proton. Like I said, they're weak. So to detect them, you have to be really, 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 really clever. Really. Not a little bit. Extremely clever, extremely sensitive. We did it. We did it with something called LIGO. L-I-G-O. The Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory. The wave is hyphenated there with gravitational, so it doesn't appear in the acronym, because otherwise it would come out as LIGO, and that'd be weird. So it's just LIGO. Here's how we did it. We used a trick called interferometry, where we took a laser and we shot it down a really long tunnel. And then we bounced it off a mirror, and then we brought it back. Back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. We used the fact that light, radiation, is a wave itself. And like any waves, you can combine waves together. And if you combine them where it's peak to peak, everything amplifies. And if it's peak to trough, you can get waves to cancel out. This is like how your noise-canceling headphones work, because they meet all the incoming sounds with the exact opposite sound and everything cancels out. So you can tune your interferometer so that like no light comes back. And then if there's any little shift, if you have these mirrors for your laser just hanging from the ceiling, and then there's any little shift at all, it will break that perfect noise cancellation, light cancellation effect, and you'll be able to detect the movement. The LIGO detector is two arms perpendicular to each other. So as the gravitational wave washes over the Earth, it changes the length of these arms by a tiny bit, less than the width of a proton, but it's enough that it shows up in this interference pattern. Of course, this is way harder to do than it sounds. It took nearly 25 years for the LIGO collaboration to make it work. And that's because gravitational waves aren't the only things that make these giant mirrors at the ends of your tunnels move around. If a truck drives outside, if there was an earthquake on the other side of the world, if someone's eating a sandwich in the control room, there's all this noise and vibration and in order to detect a gravitational wave, you needed a detector sensitive enough that it could actually pick up signals that are smaller than the width of a proton. And so it took years and years and decades to figure that out. And then once you had the sensitivity, there are all sorts of other things that are causing those mirrors to move. And so you need to understand those sources of noise to make sure you're not making a mistake. Like, imagine you're in your jungle, you're listening to your, what was it, the ruby throated golden warbler, and you're trying to listen for it, and then a hurricane comes in, and the hurricane may just make a random sound that happens to briefly sound like at least a part of the bird call of the ruby throated golden warbler. So the people behind LIGO, this massive collaboration, they had to understand where the noise might come from. They had to be able to filter it out. They had to understand their instrument. It took them 25 years of advancing technology and theory and fine tuning to make one good enough and to search for patterns in those signals. These mirrors are constantly vibrating from all sorts of things, filter out the noise, look for something that matched one of the templates. As you might imagine, a giant interferometer that is miles long, that's waiting for just anything to pass over it, may not be the best at pointing to sources on the sky. Like, yay, we got a gravitational wave. Where'd it come from? I don't know. So we needed multiple detectors. LIGO itself has two, one in Washington State, one in Louisiana. There's a third companion, the Virgo Collaboration, based in Italy. And by triangulating, they can get better. It's still not very, very precise, but they can pick out the source of gravitational waves. And that's because they know the gravitational waves that travel the speed of light. So the gravitational waves will hit one detector and then another and then a third. And depending on the timing, they know which direction, general direction of the sky to look for. But still, it took 25 years, a quarter century. I haven't done a quarter century doing anything. Except maybe eating cheese. That's my life achievement. But a quarter century working on one instrument to get it to work. That's dedication. And it's somewhat amusing. Back in 2015, they had already been working for a quarter century. They were slowly working out the bugs. They were making the detectors more sensitive. They were understanding their noise. They had just finished upgrades, a series of upgrades, and they were in a test run when CHIRP. That's right, CHIRP. On September 14th, 2015, a signal came through that matched one of the templates. This was a template of two black holes merging. But the research run, the actual let's go look for gravitational waves run, wasn't supposed to start for another 3 days. The people at the station who saw the CHIRP said, did you just see what I just saw? Because there's a CHIRP, there's a signal, there's black holes merging. They didn't know if this was a blind test. This is something that the LIGO collaboration did very well. Would there be a team who is in charge of like fire drills, basically, but for science? And they would insert signals in to see if the software, the noise cancellation, the template matching algorithms actually worked. And so the people actually running it don't know when these tests are happening. So they got the signal. They're like, ha ha ha, we're doing another file drill. We'll do another test. Okay, we'll do the things we're supposed to do, which is alert the rest of the collaboration. Surprise, it wasn't a test. They weren't even quite ready for it. But as soon as they developed the upgrades to increase their level of sensitivity right to the edge of where they thought black hole signals might be. Basically, as soon as they turned on the machine and it was sensitive enough to find black hole signals, they found black hole gravitational wave signals. This CHIRP signal, it's called a CHIRP because this template, this gravitational wave pattern for merging black holes has a very distinct shape to it, a signal to it, a very distinct fingerprint to it. Like once you hear the ruby-throated golden warbler, you can never unhear it again. And when black holes merge, as they get closer together in that last fraction of a second, they're close enough They're moving fast enough that they start to generate some real serious gravitational waves. And so you get a ramp up. The amplitude ramps up. The frequency increases because the black holes are getting closer and closer. And so they're stirring space-time even faster. So the amplitude goes up, the frequency goes up, and then the black holes merge. And there's a big collapse. And then there's something called a ring down because the newly merged black hole is vibrating like this. And then it calms down. It's over and done with in 0.2 seconds. This particular event, called GW150914, 15 for the year 09 because it happened in September, and then 14 because it was the 14th of September, it lasted 0.2 seconds. The frequency range ran from 35 hertz to 250 hertz. And if we converted that to sound, you can actually hear it, which is a real treat because this is a podcast about astronomy. So I usually have to describe things with words. But this time we can all experience together. We can actually listen to it. What I'm about to play for you is the actual chirp, the actual gravitational wave signal converted directly into sound. So the amplitude of the gravitational wave signal goes up. The amplitude of the sound wave will go up. The frequency of the gravitational wave will go up. The frequency of the sound wave will go up. It's from 35 hertz to 250 hertz. It lasts just 0.2 seconds, so I'm going to put it on repeat for a while so you can hear it. Check it out. This is what it sounds. If you could hear gravitational waves from merging black holes, this is what you would hear. Let me modify this a little bit. I'm going to keep the timing. Because remember, this whole thing happens in 0.2 seconds. These two black holes collide in that fraction of a second. But let me ramp up the frequency a little so it's more in the middle of the range of human hearing. What you heard from 35 hertz to 250 hertz is like way down low. Let me adjust it so it's right in the middle. Here, check it out. Go to patreon.com/pmsutter to support the show. Did you hear that? Okay, I'm just kidding. Here it is. This is real, folks. What you're hearing is a gravitational wave converted to sound. A tiny ripple in space-time, no bigger than a proton, generated when two black holes, one 35 times the mass of the sun, the other 30 times the mass of the sun, collided with each other over 1.4 billion years ago. That's well before multicellular life appeared on the Earth. As far as our observations can tell of this event, there was no light, there was no flash, there was no explosion. This all happened in complete silence, in complete darkness. Two shadows merging in the dark. That one event released more energy in the form of gravitational waves than 50 universes worth of stars. The entire event lasted for 0.2 seconds. And all that remains is that one little chirp in our detectors. More to come in part two. Thank you to my top Patreon contributors this month. It's patreon.com/pmsutter to help keep the show going. Matthew K, Justin Z, Justin G, Kevin O, Duncan M, Corey D, Barbara K, Neuter Dude, Robert M, Nate H, Andrew F, Chris L, Cameron L, Nalia, Aaron S, Tom B, Scott M, Rob H, and Lowell T. It's your contributions and everyone else's that keeps this show going. Also, what keeps the show going are questions. Tons of questions about gravitational waves. Eric M on email, Matthew S on email, Brandon B on email, Sean L on email, Lothian53 on Patreon, Ray F on email, at I Tush Patush, it's a real name, read it for the first time on Twitter. Scott M on email, at JRods560 on Twitter, at A Piper on Twitter, Craig B on Facebook, at Eduroka on Twitter, Mike R. on email, Mary T. on Facebook, at WarDog Computer on Twitter, at Laser314 on Twitter, Jason G. on email, and at Ken987779331 on Twitter. Thank you, everyone, for your questions, and I'll see you next time for more Complete Knowledge of Time and Space.